Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, this one's for you, Sean, of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Even if you don't know what movie that music was from, you certainly recognize it. You know it's the work of Ennio Morricone. Morricone died recently, age 91, left behind hundreds of film scores, one of the most renowned film composers in history. And I wanted to talk about his legacy on this week's podcast, in part because, I got to be honest, I know precious little about Morricone, about the films of the 60s and 70s. This is all stuff that I am at the most rudimentary level of understanding of. And so when confronted with the vastness of his catalog, and I started poking through it and realizing how much of it actually had become familiar to me through secondary and tertiary means, you know, whether it's Metallica or whatnot, I realized that I was struggling and I was suffering from lack of knowledge. And because of that, I wanted to double down and absorb as much as I could and invite people onto podcast this week to help educate me and maybe a bunch of other people about what Morricone did and why it was so unique. So we're going to have two conversations this week. First, we're going to have Josh Rothkopf calling in. Josh is a writer about film and editor who wrote a piece for the Times on some Morricone greatest hits and deep cuts. And later, our beloved John Perellis, JP, is going to call in because JP actually got to go to Rome to interview the maestro. So we're going to hear that story and talk a little bit about Morricone's more eccentric side. So starting off first, Josh Rothkopf is here. Thanks for being here. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Josh, if you don't know, was the film editor at Time Out New York for many, many, many years, now writes for us at the paper, Sight and Sound, et cetera, et cetera. A font of film knowledge and film history. Here's the thing. So Josh, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, I come at this from the music side. And to be honest, I don't watch a lot of old films. So some of the Morricone greatest hits came at me through other formats, whether it's commercials or covers or things of that nature. I didn't necessarily see them or hear them in C2 in their original context. Some of the stuff, even the most popular stuff, even is still a little obscure to me, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. Tell me from the film perspective, tell me about your earliest exposure to Ennio's work. And what were the reasons that it jumped out at you, especially as someone who I'm sure, as a professional film critic and a thinker about film, you know, there's any number of people who are exceptional score writers. What specifically jumps out? When did it jump out at you? And what specifically jumps out about the maestro?
Wow. Well, that's a question that goes very deep into my past.
That's why we're here, man. That's why we're here.
I hate to be that guy who says his dad introduced him to it, but I think I've got to be that guy. When I was
shouts
in high
dad.
School,
shouts to your dad. Yeah,
shouts to my dad. I'm pretty sure he turned me on to a Western from Italy called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is Sergio Leone's great Western. And I was, I think, maybe 16, maybe 15, and I was a guitar player, And I was struck by a composer who was supplying the grandeur for what looked to be like a classic Western, but was also using guitars and in a very forward way. And it was so modern, and it was exhilarating, and it was weird, and there were voices, and it was like a coyote, like, ah, you know, it was unlike anything I had ever heard. And I think the shock of the strangeness, this wasn't like Wagnerian, like something like John Williams was. And to my 16-year-old brain, it sounded very experimental and wild, and I was hooked. And I wrote a whole college thesis about Sergio Leone when I went to school.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I learned a lot about Ennio in that time and the different kind of shades of Ennio, the different styles that he would explore. And I came to realize that he was more than just a composer and a supplier of music. I think the way I began to think of him was like a celebrator of these movies. Like if you think about Sergio Leone, Dario Argento, the horror filmmaker, Brian De Palma and John Carpenter, Quentin Tarantino, all five of those directors, they love genre films and they celebrate them and they think they're the best. And I think that Ennio is sort of a kindred spirit of those filmmakers, and he collaborated with all five of them. The idea that he was is somehow kind of seeing these stories and amplifying their emotions and taking them as seriously as the directors were taking them and sort of turning their aural soundtrack into something that was just as heightened, just as big, and just as embracing.
Well, okay, we let's actually take one step even further backwards philosophically, because we haven't talked on podcasts very much about film music. And I wonder if it might be useful. Look, there are obviously 5, 10, 15 essential film scorers who people who are interested in this are most excited about. But I wonder if you can talk even more broadly about the philosophy of scoring a film. Is historically speaking, a film score meant to be additive? Is it meant to be a parallel narrative driver? What function does a score historically serve? And I'm sure it's multiple, but maybe if we understand the historical use of film score, we can also assess through that lens what made Ennio so special.
I think that, that is definitely a great way to think about it. In the role of the film score has itself kind of evolved over time. In the beginning of movies, before sound even, in the silent era, the score had a very prominent place and was conveying, I think, a lot of the emotional language. And I think that you could, in a grand generalization that probably should be taken with a heaping grain of salt, I think that you can think about composers maybe in two different categories, composers who sort of tried to be unobtrusive and tried to not be noticed and basically tried to support the story that the director and the actors and the writer was telling. And then there are composers who definitely have a style and you notice their work and suddenly it's in dialogue with maybe the director's voice or in dialogue with an actor's voice. And I think when you think about those scorers, you're talking about the first scorers like Dmitri Tiomkin, Franz Waxman, and Bernard Herrmann, who worked with Hitchcock on so many different films. And suddenly everyone in the audience is hearing Psycho and that and understanding that the composer is just as much of an element as the knife and the shower and Janet Leigh and Norman Bates and everything else. That Bernard Herrmann's work in Psycho is just as prominent and just as essential to the success of that movie as anything else. And so in that sense, I think that Morricone is best seen as someone who is an equal creative shareholder or collaborator in a project.
Maybe the other half, the companion question philosophically, is, well, because we were talking about the intent of the approach of the composer, but I also wonder about the intent of the approach of the directors, because the directors that you mentioned, the ones who worked extensively with Morricone, those are people who perhaps if they're not writing with the specifics of the music in mind. They are willing, in their mind, they're saying, I know at the end of this, Ennio is going to add something that amps up the drama, the narrative, the tension, the so on and so forth. And that's sort of baked into the presentation, I would assume, from jump. Yeah, rather
absolutely.
Than, yeah, and I imagine not every director is like that.
No, not every director is like that. But with Morricone, you're really talking about a situation where, in fact, Sergio Leone would play Morricone's music on the set when he was filming the scenes. Morricone composed the music for Sergio Leone's Western Once Upon a Time in the West that eventually came out in 1968. But he already had his music composed and recorded so Leone could actually play it on the set for his actors. That's the kind of thing that, like, Sergei Prokofiev used to do on Eisenstein sets in the Soviet era. But that's how intimately linked those two filmmakers were, Leone, the director, and Morricone, the composer. He was someone who was emotionally supplying the actors with cues through his composer. So take, for example, Morricone's work on John Carpenter's The Thing. John Carpenter already is known as a kind of a brilliant composer in his own right, minimalist and brilliant. And at the same time, when he's making The Thing, which is a remake of his favorite movie, he decided to contract with Morricone, who is a composer that he basically deified. John Carpenter loved Morricone's work so much. I think he even had Morricone's music playing at his wedding.
How long did that marriage last?
Well, it was to Adrian Barbeau, right? So, but it's the kind of thing where if Carpenter is giving Morricone the reins to a movie of his, and this is a guy who easily could compose his own music, that gives you a sense of how trusted he is by these creative directors to not only hold their own and support a story, but to really add some kind of a special vibe. There's something that's voluptuous and romantic and heightened and histrionic about Morricone. Even when he's taking risks, they're so juicy and adventurous. You can't not admire that he's going there.
Let's actually listen to some music from Morricone in Carpenter's The Thing. Okay, so Josh, you wrote, the piece that you wrote was sort of a kind of, I don't want to say a greatest hits, because it was designed to be both, it seems like a primer of essentials with also a few deep cuts thrown in. The best known stuff is obviously the Western stuff, but one of the things that I was struck by when I was kind of studying up for this was the versatility of Morricone and the different kinds of styles, the different instruments. So much flexibility when it comes to just like something as simple as what is the instrumentation going to be. Can you talk to me about one or two high water marks that are not the Leone stuff, not the best known stuff?
Can I do three?
Yeah, sure.
I feel like Morricone has four general phases, and we've already talked about the Westerns. That would be the first. Like this idea of someone who is expanding the vocabulary of what belongs in a Western and taking Link Wray and Duane Eddy's guitar and foregrounding that. Then I think it's so wonderful that Morricone had kind of like a side gig in Italy working as the composer of these giallos. Giallo is a subgenre of horror. They're like thrillers that basically derived out of Italy. They often feature killers and black gloves. They're basically really stylish, often violent. Some of Morricone's most strange and arresting work came in giallos. So if you're talking about Dario Argento, I think has a claim to have made one of the earliest giallo films. It's a film called The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. It's from 1970. And Morricone's score in that is so hypnotic and strange and very disturbing. It has la la la's in it, sort of like a deranged killer singing, and it has twinkly sounds and dark strings. It's just, he's supplying a signature for an entire genre. That extends through movies by Mario Bava and other other giallo filmmakers, and Morricone was often the guy that they went to.
Let's play a little bit of The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. In the way that Leone's relationship to Westerns was to sort of use the formal structures, but internally kind of question and comment upon the form. And it seems like these giallo films maybe are also maybe slightly referential or meta in some way. How does the music assist in encouraging the viewer slash listener to philosophically engage with the project? What is it that the music's doing? How does it increase inquisitiveness in the listener or the viewer?
I think that the music gives us a cue as to how we're emotionally supposed to be predisposed towards a movie. In the giallo sense, Morricone is making creepy music. He's using voices in a way that is strange and unusual. He's using tonalities that are bizarre and they're not major harmonies. But another really interesting way of thinking about this is, there's a score that Morricone did for a film called Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion that I mentioned in my piece for the Times. And I feel like this is a great example. The movie is about a corrupt police inspector who kills his mistress and then hopes to be caught by his own force. This is a very dark concept to build a film around. And if that had been played straight, I think it would have been unbearable as a piece of entertainment. But Morricone supplies almost a Blackly comic score that has a mouth harp in it, has a big boing in it at the beginning. It has like mandolins and sort of mincing strings and bassoons. There's something that's very comic and conspiratorial about the score. And as a result, it steers us to say, oh no, this isn't a dark film. This is a comedy, or this is a very black satire. It helps us orient ourselves in terms of how the director wants us to receive their film, instead of taking it all that seriously, to see it as tongue-in-cheek. And that's all Morricone doing that.
Does it take a certain confidence in director to know that that much of the lift is going to come from the score, rather than having the score simply be in service? You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And I think that it requires a director to sort of relax into the collaboration. Morricone has butted heads with directors over his career. He tried to work with Terrence Malick, who is famously fastidious, Kubrickian in terms of his control of a film set. Terrence Malick and Malick and Morricone butted heads on their work together for Days of Heaven. Still, it resulted, I think, in some really beautiful music, but you know, there was a lot of conflict there, a lot of rejection of Morricone's original spirit, and then rescoring and trying different ideas. I think that Morricone is somebody who sort of complements a director who's also strong. You know, sometimes it was magic. Very often, I'd say it resulted in magic. Sometimes it kind of overwhelms the director's vision, where Morricone is doing a better job of supplying the emotions of the story than the screenwriter sometimes.
You don't have to name names. It's okay. They, you know, if they're alive and they're listening, they know we're talking about.
I think they agree. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you were saying there are sort of four phases or four categories with Morricone. We talked about the first two. What's the third?
There's a side of Morricone that's very loungy. Some of this music was in movies. Some of it was on the radio in Italy and elsewhere. And it's this kind of, it's a groovy pop side of Morricone that I'm crazy about. There was a collection that came out called Mondo Morricone that actually spawned two sequels. There was More Mondo Morricone and then Molto Morricone. And these were just his lounge music tracks. And you, if you start listening to this music, you're going to become addicted, obsessed, and no other music is going to do it for you. I know this sounds hyperbolic, but I'm telling you, this lounge music is incredible, and it really brings to light something essential about the composer's style, which is that he would take a melody and repeat it over and over again and, you know, just build on it subtly over the course of a 2 or 3 minute long song. I think a good example of that is his theme song for Mario Bava's Danger Diabolique. It's a song called Deep Down. And that song is very much of its moment. It's kind of a psychedelic fuzz guitar song, but it's also so Morricone. Once you taste it, you can't forget it.
You also pointed out in your piece, this film was sort of an inspiration for the Beastie Boys as well.
Absolutely. The body moving video, it comes from this movie, Danger Diabolique. And Danger Diabolique has a huge following. Sometimes the music sounds a little like a Batman, but I also
I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, let's listen to a little bit of the theme from Danger Diabolique. Now, to your point about that, of all the songs that you included in your piece, this is the one that got me thinking about this question the most, which is, can you talk about the ways in which Morricone's music was in dialogue, or maybe wasn't, but I feel like was, with prevailing pop music or pop ideology? Obviously, we don't always think of film scores as being in dialogue with pop, but he does seem hyper aware and is interested in experimentation in formal structures and also in sonics in a way that makes me think that he's not totally closed off. But then when I've read interviews with him, he does seem like he's just a guy trapped in his house. So maybe he is closed off. So I wonder if what you know about his either direct or indirect dialogue and commentary with actual pop music.
I know that he was a voracious listener and that he loved watching new movies that he wasn't working on. And I think that obviously, like a lot of composers of the time, he was hearing, you know, James Bond scores, he was hearing John Barry, he was hearing music like Frank Sinatra and early pop and also rock and roll. When you have Morricone including electric guitar, and not just like twangy electric guitar, but like fuzzed out psychedelic guitar, I think that really tells us that this is somebody who's aware of like Jimi Hendrix. This is somebody who's aware of I think, the most interesting rock that's happening at the time. In fact, I know that Metallica used to use a Morricone track as their intro music before their concert started. I think it was Ecstasy of Gold from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I think that rock musicians respond to Morricone because he doesn't sound like he's faking it. He sounds like a real fan of rock. You know, he sounds like he really loves like a power guitar chord. And also, if you listen to Deep Down, it could just as easily be a Bond song. It could be a Bond theme song. There's something voluptuous about the strings in it combined with the voice. And when we move into the 70s and even the 80s, you get a sense that Morricone is changing up his instrumentation. He starts using the synthesizers. He starts using drum machines. By the time you reach The Untouchables, which is his score for Brian De Palma, you know, you have triggered drum percussion and synthesizers and orchestra. He's staying current. He's staying up to date with trends in music.
Okay, so what's in your mind then the fourth phase of Morricone?
The fourth phase of Morricone is, I think, his spiritual side, for lack of a better word. I don't really know Morricone's personal, you know, connection with faith and religiosity, but I do know that there's a bucket of his composing that doesn't fit anything that we've talked about so far. And it's very sincere. It's very open-hearted, very romantic. And I think about his scores for Cinema Paradiso or The Mission, which is glorious, emotionally pummeling music. It's massed harmonies and it's, you know, major seventh, you know, wows of choral music. And I think that The Mission is a perfect example of a Morricone score that's even more famous than the film itself. And it's about missionaries in South America in the 17th century and 18th century, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting, where they are interacting with indigenous people and they're using music to try to bridge the cultures. And that's basically saying, Ennio, help us out here and make a beautiful piece of music that's going to make our film work. And, right, and he composed, right. You know, it's
if
like,
if this music doesn't work, the whole damn thing doesn't work.
Save our film and make the film work with your music. And he does.
That's a convenient trick of a filmmaker to leave a space for a moving piece of music and then put the entire emotional weight of your film on that blank space and then just go beg Ennio Morricone to basically be like, look, the other 90 minutes of this, I don't know about, but these 3 minutes, they really got to go.
Exactly.
So like, please, I'm begging you here.
I mean, if you watch Cinema Paradiso, that's what I consider to be Morricone's masterpiece. It's so emotional, but that's an example of like what you're talking about, where the climax of the film, which I won't spoil for the listeners, there's no dialogue at all in it. And it's all Morricone carrying the emotional weight of that moment. And it works, you know, fabulously, but it's the kind of thing where, yeah, there has to be a lot of confidence in your composer to give him that moment. And by the 80s, the late 80s and the 90s, Morricone is at the peak of his powers and he can basically do anything. This very romantic, very sincere side of Morricone, sometimes people think it's a little too syrupy. I love it. It definitely fits its own category, its own subdivision.
Let's listen to the part from The Mission that you wrote about, which is Gabriel's oboe. So before we wrap up, something that I was thinking a lot about is the influence that Morricone had on later film scorers, later composers, because there's so much that he did that felt, you know, I mean, it's trite to say, but very, very signature in terms of conceptual approach. And I wonder, is there a post-Morricone school that feels deeply indebted to him, or is what he did so kind of particular to the uniqueness of his talent that people are kind of like, we're not even going to try. Like, you know, we listen to it, we appreciate it, but like, we can't touch that. We're not even going to go.
I really am leaning towards the latter. I don't think I know that Morricone's own son, Andrea, who co-composed Cinema Paradiso, he contributed a theme to that score. He composes in a way that's very similar to his dad. And it's down to specific harmonies, specific uses of chords, turns of melody. But I really do think that today's modern scoring has really veered away from Morricone's style. And it's become a lot more, I don't know, it's sort of, I think about Hans Zimmer. That's an example of a he's pounding you with rhythmic elements. And if you listen to his work in Christopher Nolan movies, there's a lot of ticking clocks and ticking percussion and drones and the Zimmer bong sound in something like Inception or whatever. I mean, that's a completely different aesthetic of composing. And it's much more minimalist. It's much more straightforward. And I think it has a lot. It owes a lot to, say, someone like John Carpenter, who's using synthesizers in a way that's very straightforward and kind of basic. Morricone, I think, at root is a voluptuary. He's romantic. He loves choral music. He loves Bach. He loves the high romanticism of someone like Mozart. That kind of composing is not fashionable these days. He's definitely one of a kind. And I wish there were more Morriconians out there. There are the fans of Morricone, but I don't hear a lot of it in terms of modern day scoring. I mean, do you?
No, I mean, it's interesting because I've been thinking in the last year or two about the, I guess, class, a group, cohort of indie and young experimental electronic music producers who have sort of shifted to film scoring. At least partially, I think, because it's probably a little bit more financially stable than just kind of like, you know, making records that don't make a lot of money and touring venues that don't have a lot of people in them.
What's touring? Wait, what is this? What is this?
Well, yes. Yeah. Sorry, this is a. I was momentarily flashing back.
What is this
venues
you speak of? What is that?
Right, I was momentarily flashing back to 2019. but I, you know, but when I hear, you know, like a 10 Tricks Point Never, you know, folks like that. I don't know if I hear the quirk, and I don't know if I hear that narrative foregrounding. I feel like I hear soundtracking and amplification, but not this other thing.
And you're hearing, yeah, in the horror films, like especially like something like Midsommar or Hereditary or It Follows, you're hearing this really interesting influence of John Carpenter, right? You know, and like you're saying, the electronic stuff, but nothing that sounds classically derived like Morricone.
I agree. But I think generally speaking, look, at least some of that's got to do with you have a generation of directors who were raised on different musical influences. So like they may not be seeking classical influence. That's just not on their table.
It's a shame in some ways too, because having access to that vocabulary, the sort of grandeur and size of an orchestra, especially an orchestra that's supplanted with a 40-piece choral group and an electric guitar and some two sets of kit drums and some kind of crazy synthesizer. I mean, then you're really talking about a kind of prog rock. I know that that could be like a dirty word to some people, but it's
unfashionable.
Unfashionable, but it's very proggy sometimes. It's unfashionable. I wish that I mean, and every once in a while, there's a retro film that comes out. I think about something like Amer, which is like a sort of a retro-made giallo film that uses old Morricone music. And you think, why can't we have this anymore? And then, of course, Tarantino, who's using Morricone for The Hateful Eight. So that's new music that Morricone composed as well as old music that he composed that was never used. So I feel like there are certain directors who I think want to use that palette of sound, but there are few and far between.
I know you got more in the tank than the eight that are in this piece. Give me a left field one for us to go out on.
I think a left field one to go out on that I really wish I could have included is a piece of music called Invenzione per John. It's in a movie called Duck, You Sucker. And this is from 1971. It's Sergio Leone's last Western. And it stars James Coburn and Rod Steiger. And this piece of music by Morricone, Invenzione per John, is so evocative of the 70s and Westerns and the kind of tension between character and story. And it has a sort of a cosmic grandeur to it that I find it's like catnip for me. And it's also very Morricone. If you start with this piece of music, it will lead you down a rabbit hole. I take no responsibility for the amount of time you're going to spend on Morricone.
Ah. All right, so we'll go out with that. Josh, thank you for your time and for your expertise and your passion.
John, it's so much pleasure talking to you. Thank you for having me.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihe.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like Gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called Gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Go
So I had Josh Rothkopf, who did the Morricone playlist, who used to work at Time Out New York. What he actually did is he had like a sort of like four chapters of Morricone that he mapped out.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of, that was useful as framing. So I think that that kind of frees us up to kind of do like a little bit more filigree and looser stuff.
But what were his four chapters? I mean, one was
the Westerns, the Giallo films, which were kind of like the meta mafia films.
Yeah, thrillers.
I forget the third one. And the fourth one was the like hyper sentimental stuff, like the Cinema Paradiso, yeah, et cetera.
Mission, yeah. We should add a fifth chapter, which is the group of improvisation new consonants, which is basically him and a bunch of wacky Italian guys in the 60s being John Zorn before John Zorn was, you know, out of high school.
Okay, talk to me about that, because actually John Zorn wrote a tribute to Morricone in the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were kindred spirits.
Zorn did a whole album of Morricone songs.
Oh, I did not know that.
Called The Big Gun Down.
Does it slap?
Yeah, it does actually, because I mean, it's he exaggerates all of the weird timbre combinations.
There are plenty of those.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because we mentioned in the other segment the Metallica cover of Morricone, and they used to use Morricone as intro music. But in preparation for this episode, I listened to the Metallica cover, and I thought the Metallica cover was bad. I thought it was like not as cool as the original.
No, the originals are totally cool. I actually think part of this is what makes Morricone so great was he played trumpet in jazz bands. He studied classical music, and he played in this noise improvisation group, the group of improvisation new consonants with some other crazy Italian musicians. And all three of those, just like the love of noise, the sort of rich classical operatic side, and the like let's swing side, all combined in his soundtracks.
And do you think that like the dynamics of that kind of music, how much do you see the dynamics play out in his scores?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, I like the crazy 60s and 70s stuff the most. I like the stuff where he's being boisterous. I'm not that big on the big string-laden, gorgeous, sentimental movie themes. I really like where things collide. And that happens more in his early years. John Zorn, a noise musician who is wildly eclectic and looked up to Morricone, did a tribute to him where he said Morricone told him, forget about the film, think about the soundtrack album. So I have the feeling that maybe Morricone has music that he was constantly writing, and who knows if he just like took it off the stockpile and sent it to the director. I wouldn't put it past him.
Right. At least in some cases, he would compose for the film before the film was filmed.
Yeah. Well, details.
So yeah, seriously. Also, I would like to say to any musicians listening, don't think about the album. Think about the podcast. So just, you know. JP, you also got to interview the maestro.
This was like one of the great thrills of my life.
So tell me about that. I don't think I was yet at the paper. I think it was right before I got to the paper. So I did not know that you had done this until like 2 weeks ago. Tell me how that came to pass and why was it such a thrill?
Well, it came to pass because Morricone basically spent his entire career in Europe, mostly in Rome. And finally, an Italian promoter convinced him to come to the U.S. and tour. So he played a very serious gig at the United Nations, and then he took his orchestra to Radio City and around the country. But this was his first American tour in 2007, which is kind of pretty late to be making your first American tour when you're as famous as he is. So that was the news hook, as we say in the biz. You know, I said, can I interview him in Rome? And to my surprise, got an affirmative answer from his camp. He has the Roman Palazzo you want to live in, which is looking over the Campidoglio Hills. He has a parlor you could probably park an airplane in with a grand piano tucked into one corner, sort of insignificant in this vast expanse of space. The decor was very interesting. The decor was like one of his soundtracks. He had a classical tapestry on one wall, and he had all of these like scary modern abstract pictures elsewhere, He had a coffee table that looked like a rhinoceros, a realistic rhinoceros.
What?
Yes. So you had this combination of, you know, elegance and tradition and Italianate splendor and all this scary stuff, which is exactly what the coolest of his soundtracks do.
Did he have an interior decorator? No, I'm just playing.
Oh, the other thing is he was very thoughtful and gracious, but he was also like not suffering fools gladly.
That energy comes through in your piece, because I couldn't quite tell in your piece if he was, how can I put this? Basically, if he was like stymieing you, if he was kind of like, yeah, like I get it that you have these good questions, but like, I don't have the patience for it. I'm a gentleman, but also like, I don't want to do this. Like, tell me what the energy was along those lines.
I had spent like the week before trying to listen to all 400 soundtracks. So my mind, which I still haven't done, obviously, but my mind was pretty scrambled. I had like bits and pieces of ideas of soundtracks I wanted to talk about, most of which he, except for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which he explained as three instruments, the flute, the ocarina, and the voices were The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, and then he said in your review that he's giving away too many family secrets.
Yeah.
Right?
But mostly when I asked him about specifics, he brushed me off. But he also talked about contamination, the key of modern culture. And I thought it was a great word. Because his classical, beautiful, sentimental, operatic themes are contaminated with these electric guitars and, you know, jaw harps and just weird noises. I like the idea that he had thought this through.
Do you feel like, because I feel like sometimes when you interview somebody late in career, they're, some people are, you know, as I like to say, they're old enough not to care, and they'll just tell you everything. And there are some people who are like, I basically made it this far without having to explain myself. I'm not going to start now. What did he give you? Which of those, if either?
I thought it was somewhere in between because he explained a lot. That idea of contamination, the fact that he didn't consider himself prolific, which is mind-blowing. The fact that he writes everything out. I mean, if you go to a composer now who's doing soundtracks, they've got logic on their computer. You know, they can make an orchestral string sound. They can have the thing transcribed and sent to an orchestra. He wrote all this stuff out by hand. He writes the entire score out by hand.
Right, each of the parts.
Each of the parts. Like Beethoven, you know. He did not modernize his working methods, and yet he was astonishingly prolific. The amount of music he wrote is just mind-blowing. And so much of it is good, and he had so many melodies in his head.
Which of the stuff spoke most to you? You said earlier the 60s and 70s stuff is what really sticks with you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the stuff I like. Maybe it's because the music geek in me likes the collision of ideas. You know, there are other soundtrack composers who can write a pretty tune and a sort of Baroque string backup. And it seems he turned more to those. Maybe that's what directors asked him to do. It's when he's puncturing the sentimentality that I really like him. I like the Untouchables theme. I like the Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion theme.
Let's listen to one of those. We haven't talked about the Untouchables yet. Let's talk about his music for the Untouchables. Tell me a little bit about what you like about this music.
Well, it's a march, but it's not a march. It's in the wrong meter to be a march, but it sounds very proud and imposing. He said, actually, in some interview I read, that he didn't want to write something glorifying the police. There was a colloquy with the director, and he gave him a bunch of things, and he said, don't choose number 7, and apparently he chose number 7. which makes me think there are six more Morricone themes out there. How much did that guy write?
Or who did he fawn those off on later after the fact? You never know.
But I like it because it's twisted. I like it because, you know, you think you're getting this, you know, the FBI theme, and yet it's bent. It's just a little bit odd. And that's a beautiful thing.
Obviously, part of Morricone's thing is disruptive reverence, right? It's like taking foundations and then and disrupting, you know, I don't know about fully subverting, but disrupting, tweaking, twisting upon established norms.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was very happy to be the maestro, you know, when I spoke to him. And, you know, you would see him with the 100-piece orchestra and the choir, and it was very serious stuff. But you have to think that he's like getting a chuckle out of a lot of the stuff that he did. You have to think, you know, this like sardonic, twisted humor keeps coming through. And I really like that part of him.
Did you find him funny in person?
No, he was very serious. But, you know, we were talking through a translator. He didn't speak English. It was mediated. But I thought he was very eloquent. I thought he was very thoughtful. I suspect that he has more humor with friends and family than with the New York Times reporter who doesn't speak his language.
Yes, although I do want to say to anybody who ever talks to either you or me or any other New York Times reporter, it's okay to be funny.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Please.
We appreciate it. We don't want your buttoned up self. We want the other version. I asked this of Josh Rothkopf, who was with us earlier, and I wonder what your perspective on this question is going to be, which is, to what degree, if any, do you think that he was in dialogue with prevailing pop music movements?
Oh,
during the 60s and 70s.
Absolutely. That guitar is surf rock. I want to go back to the group of improvisation, New Consonants, because in the 60s, I think it was 68, somebody's going to fact check me and find I'm wrong, they made an album called Feedback. And this was strange instrumental noises on top of a funk beat. Lots of people have sampled this. Crate digging DJs love this record. And he was clearly listening to like LA studio stuff, Hal Blaine drumming, Fifth Dimension harmonies. And I compare him in a way to Bollywood composers, because those guys would just like throw everything together. You know, they'd hear something, they'd steal it, and they'd twist it. He did a lot of that. And more power to him. I mean, welcome to postmodernism. I mean, he talked about contamination. He said to me, I mingle things and sometimes I turn into a chameleon. He definitely was listening to anything he could get his hands on. I mean, there's, I think one reason Tarantino loves him is that he has this corny lounge music side to him. And Tarantino, you know, uses it ironically and twistedly. And you know, it's meta lounge music by the time Tarantino gets to it. But I think Morricone already was knocking together scorned popular music styles with, you know, grand orchestral structures.
Do you think that the feedback loop went both ways? Do you think that there are people who worked in pop who took pointers from what Morricone was doing?
Oh, yeah. One of the things that Morricone brought was, I mean, he would take the surf guitar, but he'd put it in a weird open sonic space. That definitely filtered back. I mean, someone like Anna Calvi now, who writes these sort of gothic, dark songs. I mean, she cited Morricone as an influence. And I'm sure Metallica, you know, has some production thing that they did that they got an idea from Morricone. He would strand a rock instrument in outer space or in an open desert canyon. You get a real sense of this loud instrument in this very lonely place. And I think a lot of people drew on that, thought that was a great idea, which it was.
And again, this is a subject I just don't know nearly as much about as I would like to, but the way that he used silence and emptiness and blank space felt very, very, almost like physically palpable.
Yeah.
And that is something that I don't think about probably enough when it comes to film music, but the physicality of it. I mean, I wrote a little bit about, I think it was last year, with Uncut Gems, talking about the kind of physicality of the sound in that movie. But it's very striking when I listen to some of these, especially the earlier Morricone scores. It was very striking how the physicality often comes not from fullness, but from emptiness.
Though there is a thing about film music. Film music, you're not supposed to hear it, usually. You're not supposed to notice it. It's supposed to heighten the scene. And one of the things I like about Morricone, especially in the spaghetti westerns, is, you know, it's like the music is right in your face. So he's like, he's breaking that rule. But a lot of what film composers do is set dressing. Is, you know, it's supposed to be in the background. There's a whole zone of film composing that I call to myself the TikTok music, which is when the composer's job is just to define a pulse and build suspense, and you're not supposed to really notice it, but your heart is starting to respond to that. Morricone did one of the greatest examples of it in The Thing, which is a John Carpenter film, you know, which is just a few notes and a heartbeat. Sometimes Morricone is deeply recessive and sometimes Morricone is in your face. If we want to go for a truly deep cut.
Always.
This morning, I was looking through Morricone's and I found the Sacco and Vanzetti soundtrack, which has songs by Joan Baez and won him some awards in Italy. But I went, of course, down the track list and found the one called Electric Chair, which is basically the buzz of an electric chair. It is... It is terrifying, but I think we should hear a little of Electric Chair.
I'm scared to, but if you insist, we could certainly do that.
And here's the other thing about being a film composer. You can hide stuff. People come out of music school and, you know, no one's commissioning their symphony. No one is commissioning their cantata and they still want to make music. So you can put weird, complicated, tricky, avant-garde, academic stuff into a film soundtrack and people will think it's either horror movie music, you know, purposely dissonant to get you on edge, or goes by behind the dialogue and no one's listening to it. So there's all kinds of funny avant-garde stuff stuck into film soundtracks. That electric chair is, you know, electronic music because why not? He wanted to.
Generally speaking, like, what do you make of a composer who has these kind of radically different sides? This like very sympathetic, verging on maudlin side, experimental, freaky side. As critics especially, we're pretty used to seeing artists find a lane and stick to it, you know, within reason. Very rarely are there artists who are wildly varying album to album or even decade to decade. What do you make of a composer displaying this much flexibility?
Well, part of it is that because he was working in film music, he could do that. If somebody wanted a saloon waltz, he would write it. If somebody wanted a nervous chase scene, he would write it. If somebody wanted indigenous inflected Christian ritual, he would write it in the mission. It's a job that requires you to wear lots of hats. And if you're doing 400 plus movie soundtracks, it allows you to indulge a lot of variety. I think it's great. I mean, you know, the pressure on musicians to find that lane and stick to it is partly commercial. You can't do anything too different from what your fans want, but if you do the exact same thing, they don't want that either. But the great thing about Morricone was he embraced discontinuity and, you know, all to the better. He didn't have to be the same guy. I'm sure that when Quentin Tarantino booked him, he wanted spaghetti westerns. When Giuseppe Tornatore booked him, he wanted Baroque strings. But I suspect Morricone gave them what he wanted to give them anyway. I mean, I do love that Think of the Soundtrack album. You know, that was on that desk that day.
Okay, so that's our show. Thanks, JP. Thanks, Josh Rothkopf. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, or get on the Facebook group, subscribe to Popcast, anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer, as always, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. JP, what's a weird Morricone song that you love that we go out on?
Let's do Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion, which is that sardonic Morricone that I love. It's a police thriller, but it's not a police thriller.
All right, let's go out with that. JP, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Stay safe.
Thanks, you too.
Members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.